I would like to describe a field in which little has been done, but in which an enormous amount can be done. This field is not quite the same as the others in that it will tell us little of fundamental physics, but it will tell us much about the strange phenomena that occur just below our perception. In contrast to the natural philosophers of the past, the scientists of this field delve into the recesses of nature and show how she works in her hiding places. Their quest is to understand and create the imperceptible. After all, there is plenty of room at the bottom.
All right, hello and welcome to the Materialism Podcast, an exploration of the past, present, and future of material science. My name is Taylor Sparks, and I'm joined by my co-host, Andrew Falkowski, here at the University of Utah in the Material Science and Engineering Department. And today, we have a slightly different episode. If you've heard this show, then you know that traditionally we talk about materials, their properties, how we make them, sometimes even how they're commercialized, but we haven't really done it justice to talk about a skill set that I think our students should be getting trained in, and they really aren't. And that's how you actually go about selling these things, right? What goes into business development and selling products as they relate to materials? Now, Andrew and I are not the experts here. We can maybe sell things, but I like the pros. So we brought in a ringer. We've got Dan Wilson from Syntex. Dan, tell us about yourself.
A ringer, I'm not sure about that. I know any professor who's listening to this now probably recognizes that they do a lot of business development and sales too, right?
But the successful ones.
That's true. So, yes, I'm Dan Wilson. I work with a company called Syntex Technologies. I'm a ceramic engineer by training, from degrees from what used to be the University of Missouri at Rolla, now Missouri S&T.
And hey, that's one of the good schools for ceramics. There's not many of us left that like have strength in
three. Yeah, so there's not many left. That's right. I think it got down to two, and I'm not sure how many there are.
I mean, Alfred, Utah's traditionally been good, but Missouri S&T, that's a good place.
That's right.
Okay, so you're at Syntex. Now, I know Syntex because I've got former students that work there. Tell us about Syntex. Tell us about yourself.
So Syntex is an interesting company. I've been a carbide guy for most of my career, and I really kind of viewed silicon nitride as a bit of a niche material, not very big market. You know, didn't really get to know it very well. And then a recruiter called me about this place called Syntex that I had heard about for a long time and didn't know it. And so started researching it a bit. And Syntex is, they started out as a spine company with a different name and have really refocused into being a technical ceramic company.
What do you mean spine? They were making components for biomaterials?
Spine. So they've produced parts for over 40,000 spine implants.
No way.
It's the only, I don't know the right terminology, I apologize in advance, it's the only silicon nitride approved for in-body implants in the world, is my understanding.
Yeah, I was telling him that you guys are mostly biomaterials, but now it's expanded beyond just spinal applications.
It has. They kind of divested part of that business and refocused on just technical ceramics and also still producing those parts for spine implants, but really broadening the base a little bit and doing some acquisitions and these kind of things. But, you know, silicon nitride was fascinating for me to learn about lots of properties that I didn't know that it had. And bacteriostatic, that is not a term that I knew.
It
defeats, you know, key bacteria that are of concern for, you know, an in-body implant, something
MRSA
like that.
MRSA and things like that.
That's right. And then it's also osteoconductive, yep, which is another term that I did not learn in school or anywhere. It promotes bone growth. And then it also has properties for imaging through X-ray that are very helpful to the surgeon. So it's been an interesting material to get to know, but it's not really my sales emphasis. Really what I work on is products that are sold at their Maryland facility. They acquired a company that the initials TANT, and acquired that company about a year ago. And it was, you know, Dr. Fehrenbacher had a team of brilliant materials people that worked on close to 150 SBIR projects over the history of the company, several decades. And so after this acquisition, now Syntex is looking at this company that had worked on dozens of different material technologies and was in, you know, figuring out which ones were ready to scale, which ones was really the world interested in, then, you know, in them producing. So that's when I was brought on about 9 months ago to help in that process.
Okay. So how challenging has it been for you? You came in with a technical background, you're a ceramics person, and now you're doing business development. Tell me about that. How challenging was that?
So I started out as a process engineer right out of school, and I was a pretty good process engineer. I've tried other things. I'm a terrible researcher, and I'm at best a fair manager. but as a process engineer, I was pretty good. The company I worked for was a pretty important company to the refractories industry. They bought a lot of kiln furniture for their kilns. And I got to know the salesperson for what was Norton, then Saint-Gobain. And after a while, he wound up recruiting me to move into, you know, what was called an application engineer role, which really was a technical sales role. So he convinced my wife and I to pack up and move to Massachusetts from Arkansas. And so that's when I moved up to work for Saint-Gobain and got my feet wet on the sales side.
Okay.
And so, yeah, that's a challenge because, as you mentioned, it's not something that we really train our students for. I'm not aware of it. Now, I know, you know, entrepreneurism is a little bit more of a buzzword. It was not one when I was in school decades ago.
I mean, I teach a course on it now.
Yes.
So at least it's happening some places. I don't know how common it is. I think it's still pretty uncommon for materials departments.
I suspect that's true. You know, I get the privilege of speaking at my alma mater, you know, later this week on this same topic. And it's going to be fascinating for me to see, is there any kind of response? I didn't even consider a sales role when I was in college. It was not on my radar at all.
Does it feel like giving up? Like, what? How come? Does it feel like, oh, I'm going to the dark side? So, I'm stopping to be an engineer?
That is a very fair question. I do call it the dark side from time to time.
Uh-huh.
And I was not the best in school at the time. I was not the best engineer. But I was really good at more of the interpersonal skills and these type of things. And it took me a few years to realize that that's a valuable skill set to people. And
especially
so,
among engineers. That's like a superpower.
I'm not gonna condemn all engineers that we're all nerds out of, you know, that can't learn to speak. But you are right. The percentage is pretty low, I suspect, of the ones who are interested in going into engineering. It's a different skill set. It is. Yeah.
So then, being a process engineer and then becoming now an application engineer, how did you get the education? How did you go about
school
learning
hard
those?
Knocks, I'm guessing? Or?
So I did have a mentor, and when I moved to Saint-Gobain up in Worcester, there was a guy there who was pretty close to retirement. And it's funny because at Saint-Gobain, they had just created this role of application engineer. They previously had, let's say, 10 salespeople and 10 technical support people backing them up. And then they decided, the new guy in charge said, we're going to call everybody application engineers, and everybody's going to do their own technical support and their own sales. Well, as you've just described, you can imagine that's bold, right? And it is two different skill sets. And so the guy who really took me under his wing, a guy named Craig Turner, he was on the technical support side. And one of the things he taught me, you know, if you want to compare being a materials salesperson to being just any other type of general salesperson, selling pumps, selling furniture, something like that. On the material side, everything you sell, for the most part, is going to come down to a number. Either your part's got to last longer, it's got to be a certain hardness,
some
certain
killer material
properties. Certain optical properties, and it's going to come down to a number. So you're not having to, you know, if you're selling a service or you're selling a piece of equipment, hey, there's a temptation to have to make claims that your equipment or your service can do certain things that it can't. Well, you do that as a materials engineer, and you're not going to survive because eventually your customer is going to test the part, right? And it's going to come down to a number, and then either you were straight with them or you were not. And so I think that's why I enjoy the materials side so much. And what I want, you know, among the things that I would like students to understand is, you know, I'm not a used car salesman. I couldn't get away with that because eventually they're going to test the parts and you're going to be proven right or wrong. So you have to convince people with some degree of credibility that you think what you're offering is going to work in their application, the properties are going to achieve what they need, and then they have to trust you. Because I mentioned my mentor, one of the things I learned to understand from him is your customers are taking a risk to test your part. And it doesn't mean necessarily that you're on an engine for an aircraft. I mean, that's a certain level of risk. An in-body implant is a certain level of risk, right? But engineers, they're taking a risk with their boss. You know, they go to their boss and say, I want to test this new material. Is it okay? Is it going to dedicate resources to it? There's always a risk. And, you know, Saint-Gobain had this new material called Advancer, and it's a brilliant material, extremely well done, designed by a technical person who understood the market, because there was a he was allowed to be engaged with the sales team. So he knew what the market wanted, which is not always the case. A lot of times these are developed in a black box. And then the sales team was educated. They knew the process. And this material advancer really changed the entire industry. And so it was the mentor helped me understand when they're testing this material, imagine a kiln car. You know, if you're doing spark plugs or you're making sanitary ware and you're pushing a kiln car with $30,000 of product in it through a 200-foot-long tunnel kiln and your advancer beam or your plate breaks in the hot zone of that kiln, you're down for at least a week while you cool that off and pull all the parts out and get it redone again. That's an enormous risk. And so the product that Saint-Gobain was selling, it was disruptive enough that customers were willing to take that risk. But as a salesperson, I had to understand that. And we all had to understand that that was a big challenge to get over that hurdle.
All right, Dan, so what I'm hearing from you is there's a couple of key takeaways. I mean, the first one is that the material sort of sells itself. Because it's so easy to actually measure these properties and anybody can do it, they're going to find out really quickly if you oversold your product. But the second takeaway is that there's a big risk in not necessarily trusting you, but trusting that this material is not going to massively negatively impact their process, right? Mm-hmm. They're taking on the risk of a new supplier and what that will mean in terms of producing new materials. So somebody getting into this is going to have to account for those two things that they don't have to schmooze. They have to, I think, identify the right application for a new material and understand how that will impact how you're going to make your product.
So you make it sound easy identifying the right application.
Yeah, that's got to be hard.
It depends. Yeah, it's right. Sometimes a genius develops an amazing material and then goes out to try to find who wants it. You know, where could it possibly work? And that is a model, not recommending that model, but that is a model that happens all the time. As opposed to Saint-Gobain or Coors Tech, who has a very large infrastructure of salespeople, technical development people, and they come up with an idea, and they have channels already established. They have reputations with customers already established. They know who the right people are, you know, and so that's a big advantage when you have that. But it's, you know, that relationship, it really does matter. I mean, you mentioned trust. You know, Saint-Gobain, I was there. You know, among the things that I was lucky enough to get to see when I was there, one was Advancer, amazing material, changed a lot. Another was the acquisition. I don't know if you know the name Carborundum. It's still around,
yeah.
But
yeah,
Saint-Gobain acquired Carborundum. And so we were kind of the Norton division of Saint-Gobain, and they merged Carborundum with us. And basically, one day, we had a big dinner with all the Saint-Gobain application engineers and all the Carborundum salespeople, and everybody was happy. It's great. We're all going to be together. And a month later, 90% of those Carborundum people were laid off and gone. Well, what we didn't know, I talk about relationships. I won't get into the details. It would take too long. But they had a source of a company that used to be a licensee for Carborundum products, and they knew how to make them. These salespeople who had these relationships with all these customers simply went to that plant, say, do you still have those recipes? They said, yes, we do. And they proceed to clean our clock in months.
This is like Michael Scott paper
before
company.
It is because the organization at the time didn't value those relationships and didn't suspect that that could happen. And before they knew it, they were gone. And so those relationships do matter, but they had a quality material with reproducible data, like what you were saying, because you can't sell it without. But then that relationship does matter, you know, on top of that.
There's legitimately an episode in The Office where this exact thing happens.
Isn't that
those relationships are key.
They do.
All right, so those are our first story. What else you got for us?
So another one, you know, on the large company side, because we kind of kicked around a second ago, you know, what happens when the genius comes up with a new material.
Okay.
The other one on the Coors Tech side, you know, another one of the giants of the industry, Coors Tech tried to get into, you know, they were always big in aluminum oxide armor, body armor, vehicle armor. And when I started with Coors Tech, it was right after they had kind of a failed experiment getting into the silicon carbide body armor business. This was before the second Iraq war. They had tried to get into it, and it just failed miserably with a lot of finger pointing between the integrator and Coors Tech. But then the second Iraq war comes, and you know, I don't know if you know the name Rich Palicka. He was at a company called Sercom. I believe he owned it.
Mm-hmm.
And Rich had been warning you know, the military complex for decades that that there was a capacity problem on body armor, that for the next conflict and the next threats we were going to face,
they couldn't just ramp it up.
They couldn't just ramp it up. And so, you know, we get into the war, and it was not long before the military was requesting, you know, 50,000 sets, you know, 100,000 plates a month, and worldwide capacity. You know, we may not have been right in this, but at the time we estimated worldwide capacity for these really high-end ceramic plates to be 10,000 a year.
Yeah, not even close.
So now, literally, I'm getting phone calls from parents who are trying to buy body armor for their son or daughter who's in Iraq, and it's gut-wrenching, right? So our former partner that we had failed with comes back to us and says, hey, let's try again, and they send us a print, and this print has a new data point on it, and we don't know where it came from. And so this little specification shows up on the print, and we're like, why is that spec on this print? Won't go into the details, but eventually that new specification led us to find the flaw in the system. We figured out how to fix it, and then Corps Tech's massive resources and the Corps family's dedication to this type of service. They have a long history of engaging in opportunities like this that are good for the country and good for the family. And they threw their massive resources at it and scaled it up. And they are now, you know, a lot of their competition has exited the business. And as far as I understand it, they really are at the top of that market. It's an amazing success story. But it was a combination of having the technical expertise, but then also the business development. You know, it did sell itself to a point because there was huge pull from the market. I mean, you feel it. But it still required tremendous partnerships on the business development side to figure out who the right partners are to work with, for example, because everyone wanted our armor, who were the right ones we should sell to, all these type of things. And that was all a BD position that we took care of that. So, and I had a mentor in that role as well, who I learned a tremendous amount from. So it was a great experience.
So my takeaway on that one is, if I'm thinking of a student, it would be to not ignore existing products that maybe aren't quite there, to realize that there might be something you can do to adjust to them to get them to the right place.
You can.
But also to pay attention to your competitors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe somebody else gets there first, but you can innovate fast. Like maybe they get the first proof of concept or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean you can't beat them in scaling, right?
Or
in other aspects.
That's right. That's right. So on now, as far as the other side that you mentioned, you know, what about the crazy inventor who comes up with the amazing material and then he decides that he wants to sell it? And I don't know about the crazy part, but I did, you know, after doing Saint-Gobain and Corps Tech, we had looked at some acquisitions when I was with Corps Tech. And there were two that really intrigued me, is this, you know, these really small startups with really interesting materials, but no business development to speak of, and really looking for where is this material going to fit. So this is the other side of the model, right? This is also really interesting to me. And so one of them was a company called Serbide, who I was literally the second employee hired for the company. And so they have a new process, a new manufacturing process to make this very exotic, binder-free, sintered tungsten carbide. So if you know the tungsten carbide industry, most of these are cemented carbides. They're cerametts, for lack of a better term. But they had this binder-free carbide.
Like no cobalt, you mean?
No
like
cobalt,
no metal
no
binder?
No cobalt, no nickel, no none of those others. It's a sintered tungsten carbide. 90-plus Rockwell A, if I remember the number right. I mean, very impressive material used for things like water jet nozzles. Yeah. That are 50, 60,000 PSI abrasive flow. And so we had this new material, and it was very easy to go out and get meetings. I jumped on board. We got meetings. We actually started getting orders. And you notice I didn't mention that we had a process yet. At the time, what we found out, unfortunately, with the orders was that the manufacturing process wasn't quite ready yet. And this was going back in time close to, you know, 18, 20 years. I looked up Serbide the other day, and they seemed to be doing very well. So they obviously fixed the problems.
Was it a yield problem, or was it just couldn't make the form factor?
There were two problems. The form factor, if you can't make a water jet nozzle straight, you can't make a water jet nozzle.
Oh, I see.
That was a challenge. And then there were also assumptions on the cost model of raw material that you wouldn't recognize as being a potential problem until you went to scale. Once you went to scale, there's other variables that happen now, like recycling material and these kind of things. And so there were some hard lessons there that if you're going to bring a material to market like that, there are going to be surprises. There are going to be things you cannot plan for. You think you have everything licked and you've got it worked out, and, you know, everybody has a plan until engagement with the enemy, right?
Sure, yeah,
until
first contact.
That's it. And that was the challenge, was scaling that up. So that was a big setback, and we basically wound up shaking hands, and I moved on from there to the other startup that I had talked to when I was with Coors Tech. And but, I mean, that was a really interesting learning process for me, because I love the concept of having a new material. There's a lot of interest. Engineers like to work on cool new things. That is a universal truth. And this was the cool new thing. And it got a lot of interest and just wasn't quite ready to deliver yet. Another year or two and it probably would have been there. And it looks like, you know, as I look at it now, it looks like they did get there.
And that's a pretty common experience where something gets demonstrated at the benchtop level. Mm-hmm. You know, they can make a small sample, enough to at least measure the property, and it's really good. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, somebody wants to buy that material, and, oh, we've made this before. How hard would it be to scale up? And it's not a linear process.
How hard can it be?
I mean, we just did an episode with Delta Faucet where they've got a really slick new colloidal silica way of sintering components, right? And while it works at small scales, as soon as you start to scale that up, you have to worry about pulling heat out of this. Boy, it gets a lot harder, and they couldn't scale it. And now they're having this cool tech that they are waiting for someone else to solve the problem on.
You have to give me that guy's number.
Okay. Absolutely, I can do that.
One question I had, so you mentioned that it's a difficult path to go from neat idea, cool material, to then trying to establish business relations. Mm-hmm. Something that I see quite a bit is companies that already have existing business relations will develop a new material, mm-hmm. and then being able to leverage that network will probably make it more successful, because if somebody bought a material from them in the past, they probably have a specific application that they're catering towards. If they now have a new material, more likely to buy that in the future. Is that the case, or?
It's absolutely the case, yeah. That's, you know, the genius engineer who in his garage comes up with a new idea, those are generally ideas maybe that the large company wouldn't view as big enough market to develop these type of things, right? So I guess if there's a downside, because all of these organizations, there's pluses and minuses to everything, right? And probably the downside of the big organization is they only want to chase big opportunities. So there probably are innovations they could do that maybe aren't big enough. However, when they do decide to put their weight behind one, then you have that huge infrastructure of credibility with the customer that's already, you know, pre-existing. And that gets you over many hurdles that a new salesperson in a new company would really struggle with. Absolutely.
Just getting that first conversation is so hard. You're already fast-tracked into that.
Companies like Corning, I've sold products to Corning for most of my career when I was in sales. And just how many engineers could you talk to at Corning that would say, no, I don't have any interest in what you're doing. No, I'm not interested. No, we don't do that. But you call the right person on the right day, and suddenly you can be in.
It's magic.
It is a little bit of magic, and anybody says there's not luck involved is a liar, because, you know, there's always luck involved.
And so maybe that's a takeaway for our listeners, that if you're going to go down this business development rabbit hole, like, maybe it's a little bit more persistence than they're used to. I mean, think of, like, the analytical mind says, like, you tried the solution to the problem, it wasn't correct, so it just didn't work. But that's not the answer here. The answer is keep trying, right? Keep finding the right person who's got the right personality, the right product, the right speed, whatever it happened to be that lets them say, oh, I see the value in that. So it's that persistence, which is definitely not something I think we teach our students.
It's not natural. We like to be able to check a box that said, oh, I talked to 10 engineers at Corning.
I tried it.
I'm done. And there is some of that. There are places where you have to accept defeat and say, this company doesn't do what I think they should do. They're not going to be interested. Maybe you come back to them a year later. But, yes, persistence, there's a downside to persistence as well, and it's called spam filters, right, and blocking phone calls. So I spend a huge amount of my time, if there's any of my customers listening to this, you know, I try to only contact you just often enough that you remember me, but not so much that you put me in your spam filter. So that's persistence, but also being respectful of your customer's time and interest is a big deal.
Yeah, don't come to them if you don't really think that you've got something to offer.
That's it.
So that brings us to your current company you're working for, Syntex. Tell us what they're working on.
So the, you know, I mentioned the Syntex side of it, the TA&T side in Maryland, they worked on a lot of things and before their time, in fact. They worked on, you know, ultra-high temperature ceramic matrix composites. These are like carbon sick composites, these type of things for, you know, 3,000, 4,000, even 5,000 Fahrenheit operation.
These hypersonics, team, or what is this?
The team there was working on that in, you know, the early 2000s, 20 years before there was a well, I don't even call it well-defined yet, but it is being defined as we speak for the hypersonic side. You know, everybody's envious of GE. I think you had multiple GE people in, and, you know, their MI process, melt infiltration process, is genius. And the way they developed it is, you know, very envious of what they did. Very impressive. You know, lots of people in the industry know about what they did and are very impressed with the success of that operation. You know, that material is fantastic within its temperature range. And as everybody knows, there's higher temperature ranges that they're working on, and so is everybody else. And so TA&T started working on those in the 2000s, early 2000s. And then we're also in ceramic additive manufacturing, which is not new. I mean, they first printed a part in 1998. They've been printing parts for a long time and have a lot of expertise in that. But I don't want to call it a mature industry yet. There are niches within ceramic additive that I'm going to call mature niches. Investment casting, for example, and there's some medical applications that are mature, repeatable businesses that people are buying tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars of products. There's also, I mean, every printer OEM is coming out with a new printer every few years, higher resolution, higher power. And what we found on the TA&T side is that our expertise and the experience in being really kind of printer agnostic, we make our own resins, for example. We don't buy resin. And it turns out that there are people who would like process development help on new resins, these type of things. So we get to work at every position within the supply chain of additive manufacturing, from resin development. We sell resins. We actually help. We were able to put out a press release not too long ago that we're partnering with an OEM on, you know, on process development and resin development with them. Very excited about that. And then we're also working on debinding and sintering cycles for additive. There's a lot of talent on this team that get to work in every aspect of additive manufacturing on the ceramic side. It's really fascinating to see what this team has been able to do.
And being involved in so many different aspects of the process, does that help the sales pitch?
I have changed my presentation literally in the last 3 weeks to do exactly what you're saying, because you know, I'm not trying to be an advertisement here, but you asked. So yes,
go ahead.
We don't just print parts. It's been really exciting to my recognition, because I'm a little bit older than most of your listeners, I'm guessing. There were no additive manufacturing classes in school when I was in college. None. It was not even a twinkle in my eye. So we were supposed to be working on superconductors and ceramic engines. That's what we were going to work on. Yeah, that didn't work out quite as well as everybody.
We're still waiting on those.
Still waiting on those. And so on the additive side, I've had to learn a lot very quickly. And, you know, the recognition on my end that there's this need within the industry to do these, you know, to provide these type of services has been really exciting and frankly, pretty fun for me to learn about. So it's a really exciting time to be in that industry. It's not brand new. There is some maturity to it, but there's still tremendous growth going on and advancements every day.
All right. So wrapping up the conversation, I'm curious, from your perspective, what should students be doing to learn some of these soft skills? I mean, we've you know, documented a few in today's conversation, tried to point them out, but where do they learn them? Is it only learned by trying, or what ought they to do?
So, you know, they're you know, the cliche is that, you know, salespeople aren't made, they're born, or, you know, I'm sure that's been, you know, said about many things other than sales, right? And I think there is some of that, that there's some people that that's not their inclination. What did it for me in college? It was my fraternity in college, the leadership opportunities that, you know, really I was able to develop, not on purpose, by accident, within my fraternity and some other, you know, extracurricular things that I did in college, that's where I learned it. And that is one of the great things about college, you know, the best and worst time of your life. You know, take advantage of all those opportunities to do things on top of your schoolwork.
Holy cow, yeah.
And I mean, it's just a wasted opportunity. And trust me, I did waste some opportunities as well. But I did take advantage of the really important ones that really helped me build that skill set of what I think I have, which is being able to communicate with people. It's something that you know, all the grumpy old people, which I'm not that old either, think that kids today can't do this and can't do that.
Yeah.
That's probably been true of every generation for the last 100, right, kids these days. But I think I think that's something that can be developed through extracurriculars, through leadership opportunities, and also through your work. You know, would you rather flip burgers or go work and, you know, cell phones at Verizon or whatever? You know, do something that involves you making decisions and speaking to people all day long, because that's a skill set that college is not really intended to develop. That's not really what our schools.
It's like a byproduct. It's like it's an accidental benefit that when you come to college, there is so much interpersonal interaction. Mm-hmm. And I tell students all the time, like, you think you're coming here to get a degree and the classes you take and the learning there. But
yep.
Honestly, one of the biggest takeaways you're going to get out of college is the network and the people and those connections.
One question that I did have was, and maybe you've kind of touched on this a little bit, but being a process engineer first, you mm-hmm. had some technical knowledge. Mm-hmm. You understood what it was like to actually use materials that you would then be eventually selling,
mm-hmm.
or at least understood the process of what the other side was going through.
Mm-hmm.
Did that help you, right? Surely, I've spoken to a number in my employment, mm-hmm. spoken to another number of salespeople, and oftentimes technical questions come up. And the worst thing that happens is when I ask them a question, they don't know how to answer it.
Mm-hmm. So you are... You're absolutely right. It was hugely helpful to me to understand what challenges an engineer faces in a manufacturing environment, you know, and what really matters to them and what doesn't. And then having enough knowledge to understand tunnel kilns and kiln furniture and these type of things from actually having used it was a big credibility hit, boost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's academic models, I think, on credibility. I haven't studied them, but there's philosophers or whoever that have talked about it. And, you know, you can have interpersonal credibility because I'm your friend and I've had the relationship with this guy forever. And that's how Carborundum really hammered Saint-Gobain 25 years ago after that acquisition, was those personal relationships, right? But you can also have technical credibility. And you have to have one or the other. If you don't have either, then, you know, you're really behind. And so being able to talk to an oil and gas person that I understand how a drilling tool is designed, or being able to talk to a semiconductor person that I understand why purity requirements are the way they are, why coatings are needed, these type of things, you have to either be an expert in the customer's application or in your material. You know, and within Syntex, you know, among our salespeople, we have one who is really an expert on the medical device side. On our customer side, and then, you know, I'm more of a materials person, and you got to be one or the other, you know. And that makes so much difference in customers being willing to actually invest their time in even meeting with you, much less, you know, helping them solve a problem in their operation.
I think that speaks to why we have shows like this anyways. Like, why are we talking to a business development person on this podcast, which is about material science? Because it is so important to get out of just your narrow worldview of what is materials and what is your role, to understand the broader applications. So that's certainly something we try and do on this show, is expand people's, you know, view just a little bit.
Hey, give your business development person a hug, okay? It's not it's not always easy, okay?
Dan, thank you so much for coming out to Salt Lake City.
Well,
we're delighted you're here.
Yeah.
It's fun to do a recording here in person, no less. Thanks for telling us a little bit about these experiences you've had, and I'm excited to see what happens next with Syntex and wherever else you end up.
Thank you very much.
Okay. This episode is sponsored by California Nanotechnologies, or CalNano. If you've listened to the podcast, you know that we are big fans of them. We've done a couple episodes with them, and I, as a professor, have used their services multiple times over the course of my career. They have some really great services. They've helped us with spark plasma sintering at an extremely large scale, way bigger than what you're thinking. They can make some huge components. I've always had great success with them. They turn out high density, quality parts to order and pretty quick turnaround. And they also have some other capabilities, including cryo milling. Check out our episode on that. We think that they're an awesome company, and we're proud to stand by them as a sponsor of the show. The Materialism Podcast is also sponsored by Materials Today. Visit materialstoday.com to stay up to date on the latest happenings in the material science field and read some fantastic articles they have published. You can head over to elsevier.com to find out more about their journals, books, conferences, and related programs.
Thank you, as always, for listening to this episode of the Materialism Podcast. If you have questions or feedback, you can send us emails at materialism.podcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, we actually love reading those. I love reading messages from fans. And also, if you would do us a huge favor, subscribe to our show. You can find us on iTunes, on Spotify. We used to be on Google Play, but it is now on YouTube. So if you look up Taylor Sparks on YouTube, you'll find them on YouTube as well there. If you leave us a review, we think that will help other people find our content, and that would be pretty rad. And then finally, you can check us out on Instagram. We have the @materialism.podcast page. You can connect with us there, leave a comment. We post lots of behind-the-scenes stuff and videos and pictures. We think you'd like it.
And lastly, we'd like to give a shout out to Alphabot and Colabyte for making the music for the podcast. They both make a ton of really cool synthwave music, and you can check them out on Spotify and YouTube. Catch you next time.
The inventors of fire, electricity, magnetism, iron, lead, glass, silk, cotton. The makers of tools, the captors of lightning, the architect, the engineer, the musician, are all beneficiaries of the materials of this world, and are bound only by their imaginations in manipulating those materials.